First of all, just an erratum from last week, from last yesterday. Sorry, I gave you this expression for delta E, and the expression I gave you actually was the one due to D'Arcy, and I said it was the one due to Penrose. So here is the expression for that Penrose uses. So these are the densities associated with the two, the mass densities associated with the two distributions for the two different superposed terms. So this is the actual expression that Penrose uses. Okay, so today, well, first of all, I'm going to finish off talking about the collapse approach, and then I'll move on to psi epistemic. The question of whether it's possible to have a psi epistemic model. Okay. So one thing that's worth seeing, so I gave you this model with the jump process. One thing you can do is ask, well, what does this imply for the sort of average evolution? If you like, what's the evolution of the density matrix associated with this when you average out over all the jumps? So the master equation. This is the equation for the evolution of the density matrix in the GLW model. This is what it is. And this is also including a term for the Schrodinger evolution. So this is the term for the Schrodinger evolution, which is unitary. And then there's this extra term because of the jump processes. And you've got two variables here, R and R prime, because we're writing down the density matrix. It's a function of all the n coordinates, and we need to include. And the reason for that is the density matrix, if you have a pure state, is just given by putting psi back to back of itself. Okay, so there's the prime. But this thing, with this equation, it's going to evolve from being equal to a pure state to being a mixed state. So in the original GRW paper, this was the equation that they gave, and the sort of Bell's pedagogical contribution was to extract from that the story I gave you yesterday, where you have a jump process acting on a pure state, because I think it makes it clearer what's happening. Okay. So the other question we talked about yesterday was this issue of local variables. So this is the aspect of the ontology which is posited to be responsible for the appearance of a three-dimensional world. And like we discussed yesterday, if you have, in addition to this, some sort of theory for so-called psychophysical parallelism, in other words, what are the things that we become conscious of, normally you take those to supervene, to use the philosophical word, on the local variables. So there's two approaches in GRW. It's kind of not clear because the ontic state is just the wave function. And this is this big horrible thing living in the configuration space, which is 3n dimensional. So we want to extract something that lives just in three dimensions. So Bell's, and I think actually Bell was the first person to address this. He addressed it before GRW did. They later came up with a different idea for the local variables. His idea was that the jump centers the things that we label by X. Can be thought of as sort of flashes. Actually, he didn't say that. That's just they can be thought of as local variables. So if you think about it, As this wave function evolves, every now and then it's going to be hit by a jump centered at a certain point. And these jump centers can be read off the wave function. As it evolves, you can see where they are. But they live in three-dimensional space. So what's happening is you can think of these as sort of flashes, a sort of pattern speckled through space-time with these flashes. And for big macroscopic objects, there's going to be quite a lot of those going on. So a pointer sitting in this position will have quite a lot of flashes happening because there's so many particles in it. And so those are enough to give rise to something that sort of looks like a sort of three-dimensional world that we have. So that was Bell's idea. And in his paper, he has, in I think the appendix, he has this proof that there's some sense in which these jump centers, these flashes, are invariant under Lorentz transformations. So it's one of the problems with these interpretations, these class models, is that it's not clear if they violate some sort of Lorentz invariance. And although all this is just non-relativistic quantum theory, you can ask what happens if I have an entangled state with two distant systems. And what happens if I just evolve? I can perform two time translations. So either I evolve past here first, then here, or vice versa. And this is he calls this the sort of the residue of the Lorentz transformation. So it's in a mathematical sense, if you sort of take the limit, you still have this kind of residue where you consider either translating time over here first, then over here, or vice versa. It's sort of, it contains part of the Lorentz transformation. And he showed that these jump centers are invariant with regard to those translations, with regard to that two-time translation. So that may have been part of his motivation for taking these to be the local variables.
Can you say that again about the time translation? Is that the choice to evolve one side versus?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. So, so you've got some entangled state. Let me use R's. Some entangled state, but it's got two variables in it. So it's got two variables in it. And these two wave packets really they live. You can write it down. Let's try this. Like so. So there's an entangled state, for example. But you can evolve this by actually you can perform a translation on part of the wave function that's associated with system one. So you may add some small time to this or not, and that's the two-time translation.
Don't you have a problem with Lorentz invariance in that you could have, you know, one wave function could jump and the other wave function might jump to the wrong place in the interval before there's a chance for that to be communicated?
So I think, so you're asking about signaling, I think, in some sense. So you can try to conceptually distinguish the idea of Lorentz invariance, which is some invariance under Lorentz transformations, from what's normally taken to be a consequence of Lorentz invariance, which is that you can't communicate faster than light. And this is about, this is not about, yeah, this is Lorentz invariance, not no signaling. I still found this result of Bell slightly unsatisfactory because this wave function is also part of the ontology. And it's not clear this is a Lorentz invariant object. You really need a time to write it down. But it's an interesting result all the same. Okay. And then the second thing is the, so that's Bell's idea for the local variables. For Girardi, he had two collaborators, and Grassi and in 1995, they suggested defining something. They call it the mass energy, sorry, the mass density operator. I'll explain what this is. So this is, he uses quantum field theoretic sort of notation, but I think that's inessential. The main thing is this is the number operator. For particles of type K. So you can imagine you have different types of particles. And this is the number operator for particles of type K. And you take this and it's the number operator, particles of type K, and it's telling you how many there are in a volume. Centered. At X, but having some a finite size. Equal to A. A was the parameter that appeared in the Gaussian for the jump process. So what this does is if you apply this to the state, then you get something like a mass density, and it's a mass density that lives in three dimensions. Okay. So one criticism that's often leveled at the these collapse models like this is that when you apply this jump process to the wave function in configuration space, for the most part, it does cause the wave function to localize to the pointer being here and not there. But actually, there's a very small tail for the other part. So although the pointer is mostly localized here, there's a very small tail for it to have this position because you're hitting it with a Gaussian, and that Gaussian has infinite tails. So this is the tails problem. So then you have to say, you have to come up with an argument as to why those tails don't matter. And one can say, well, they do matter. They're part of the ontology. These things are really there. Why should I ignore them? And sort of you say things like, well, if they have mass density that's lower than a certain amount, they don't really matter. It's a bit feeble in some sense. And suddenly you might try to push the many worlds onto this wave function. You might say, well, these other worlds have to exist because they're there in the wave function, so you have a problem there. So this is if you look in the literature, it's called the tails problem. Another issue is that this is really an effective approach, and what you really want is some fundamental derivation. So if you're supposing that you have a solution to the measurement problem, then it would be nice to have that measurement, that solution to the measurement problem, the reality problem, understood at a more fundamental level rather than at the level of this effective theory. So my opinion on this is the following, that eventually we'll come up with a theory of quantum gravity. And then we could take that theory of quantum gravity and take a limiting process in the direction of the in the direction of the domain where quantum theory, as practiced nowadays, is empirically verified, and we'll get quantum theory, but we'll get quantum theory with small modifications that will look like a collapse model. So this thing will be essentially a collapse model. It seems that Penrose's argument makes a compelling case for that. However, this will be a more fundamental theory, and the mathematics in which this theory is couched may look very different from quantum theory, just as the mathematics of general relativity is very different from the mathematics of Newtonian gravity.
Just as a personal question, really, could you go into more detail about why you think collapse would come out of quantum gravity?
Because of Penrose's argument, the one I gave you yesterday, I think, so his argument is that it's inconsistent and something's got to give. Okay, and then he says, so let's just assume it collapses. Mm-hmm. But that's not providing a fundamental reason. To provide a fundamental reason, you have to actually give a new theory.
Yeah.
And then take the limit. But it's likely this new theory will look very different from quantum theory. But it's likely to have quantum theory with collapse as a limit. It seems Penrose's argument makes a strong case for that. The trouble is, if you want to solve the measurement problem, really you want to do it over here. Really, if you want to give a good account of reality, you want to do it in these fundamental terms. And it may be that attempting to do it over here in this effective theory would just sort of miss the point. Certainly, one would expect a better resolution over here. So my opinion is that this is very likely the correct effective theory, but it's not the best place to resolve the measurement problem. Okay, so I'm going to move on to a new topic. Are there any more questions on these collapse models before we move on? No? Okay. Right. Erase this and start over here. So there's been a lot of work recently on looking at this upper option. I think you remember when I gave you the sort of flow chart with all the different possible interpretations. There was one box for psi epistemic models. So if you don't believe the wave function is real, or if you want to investigate the possibility that the wave function isn't real, isn't ontic, then there are these psi epistemic models. So far, no one has a really compelling psi epistemic model. There is a no-go theorem. And you'll hear about this on Monday afternoon from Matthew Pusey, who's one of the principal originator of that theorem. But this theorem makes a certain assumption. It's a very innocuous assumption. However, it's possible if you contradict this assumption, it is possible to build a very ad hoc psi epistemic models. if you ignore that assumption. And there's a paper doing that, and the authors of that paper are Lewis, Jennings, Barrett, and Rudolph.
And so what, sorry, what is PBR?
PBR is Matthew Pusey, Barrett, and Rudolph. So two of the same authors appear over here.
Do you remember the names of the papers on the
article? They were exactly contradictory. So this one said, the original title of this and the title of this contradicted. I don't remember the exact title. It was something like that. It wasn't exactly that. Yeah, but they were, yeah. It did cause problems because they submitted this paper to Nature, and it had been accepted. But then they put this paper on the archive with a contradictory title, and then the people at Nature got scared. And there's a whole story there. It was eventually published in Physics, Nature. Who? Sorry.
What?
Has a paper. Right. This is more recent, isn't it?
It's quite recent.
Yeah, quite recent. Yeah. In fact, yeah. I think these are not the only. I think maybe other examples of that. Yeah. So there's been a tremendous amount of work since this PBR paper. It's become a very active field. I even have my own no-go theorem, although I think the PBR theorem is infinitely superior. Well, maybe not infinitely, but much superior to. To my own version. Yes?
Can you say what the assumption that they made is? Is it easy to exploit?
Uh-huh. Yeah, so I want to get the words right.
No preparation intentions.
Yeah, so the idea is if my system is in a product state, I have a quantum system that's in a product state, then for that situation I can associate an ontic space with each of the two systems, and the probabilities the probabilities will factorize between those two systems, so they behave independently. I forget exactly what they call the. Do you remember? Does anyone remember exactly what they call the? Preparation independence. Okay, yeah.
And how do these scientific models get around that?
By violating it. I can't tell you exactly what it is they do.
That paper weakens the collection, and the Emerson paper assumes non-local support.
Right. I mean, there is a problem with the assumption because we know that in the case where you don't have a product state, it's not true. This Bell's theorem shows you that there is this sort of manifest, has to be this non-locality. Rob Speckens gave a talk which you can watch on PERSA called Why I Am Not a Psi Ontologist. okay. So their paper. The way they construct this is by taking a model due to John Bell. This is a model just for a spin half particle, and it's a psi-ontic model. But they modify it to get a psi-epistonic model for the general case of arbitrary dimensional double spaces. There'll be some questions in the tutorial about Bell's model and another similar model.
Well, it's actually a Bell-Merman model.
Oh, is it Bell-Merman model? Okay,
yes.
Right, okay. Yeah. So I imagine that Merman sort of elaborated on it, is that right? Yeah. Okay. So I'm not going to write down this model. I don't think that it would provide a lot of clarity. It's just a very ad hoc model that you can read about in this paper. Instead, I'm going to sort of talk about related subjects. So let's start. Consider a density matrix for a spin half particle or qubit. And you'll have a lot of opportunity in the tutorial to consider this in more depth. Then you can show that A is a linear function okay. There are some particular coefficients in front of this, but you add them up with some coefficients, complex coefficients, and you get A. These are the probabilities of getting, if you do a Z measurement, these are the probabilities of getting spin up and spin down. This is the probability if you do an X measurement of seeing spin up. This is the probability of getting spin up if you do a Y measurement. So what that means is that this object contains all the same information as this object. And in fact, the two objects are linearly related to one another.
Is there a reason that you include the probability of measuring the Z down?
Yeah, so sometimes I compile lists of things I'm against. One of the things I'm against is unnecessarily normalizing quantum states. Maybe I'll get more chance next week to explain why I'm against that. But the basic reason is after a measurement, if you project this down with a measurement, then it won't be normalized. And people normally, you know, react to that in horror and quickly renormalize it. But you don't have to. And in fact, if you're interested in calculating joint probabilities, it's better to work with the unnormalized, the subnormalized density matrix. So it's better, I think, to think of this as as you know, having four parameters in it rather than just three. Now, if you want to plot the allowed states, then it's quite useful to normalize because I can't draw a four-dimensional diagram, but I can draw a three-dimensional one. So then you can draw the space of states so here's the three axes, the three probabilities on them. And these are the one marks. And what I'm going to do is draw a cube that sits just inside this first octant. Okay. And now now I want to draw a ball which fits just inside this cube, so touching each of the six faces. It's actually beyond my artistic ability, but let me just draw a big circle. Okay. I think that's how people suggest that it's actually a ball. So that's a ball. So it's just inside there. And the space of allowed states are the states that fall on the surface or inside this ball. This is just the block sphere in different coordinates. Actually, I didn't put it as an exercise in the tutorial question to prove that this is true. But no. If you run out of time, that this is the space of states.
No, there is no such thing.
No, there is. It isn't in the exercise.
There is an exercise to show that A is a linear function.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. I didn't include this. If you find yourself running out of time, or if you want to, you can always try and prove this as an exercise. You've got to prove that you prove it for the pure states, that the pure states lie on the surface of the sphere. No, it's centered on the center of this cube.
Okay. See.
Yeah. The sphere. The probability is, can't be negative, so it's got to be inside the positive quadrant.
So you can have a state that has probability one that you'll measure it in spin up in the z-axis, but also non-zero it's a hat.
And that's a spin-up eigenstate for. So this is consistent. So all the points where you touch the surface of this cube are those kinds of states. But also, I could have chosen a different basis, a different coordinate system, and then I would have had a rotated cube. Okay. So this is just basic quantum theory. This is the block ball displaced. I think it's more interesting to look at the block ball in this picture than the usual picture, because you can see how it relates to probabilities which are more immediate. So now, when you see a list of four probabilities, it does sort of raise the question, well, maybe we can think of this as corresponding to some sort of probability distribution over four ontic states. So we have four ontic states, and you might want to think, well, a quantum state can be treated as if you have a probability distribution as a histogram over these ontic states. And so different states would correspond to different probability distributions. So can we develop an ontological model for quantum theory that's like this. And the answer is, of course, no. And it's interesting to try and understand why. In fact, you can't treat quantum states for a finite dimensional system as you can't describe it by an ontological model with any finite number of ontic states. So you can prove that you need an infinite number. So this is the ontological excess ontological excess baggage theorem, I apologize for that that name for the theorem. It was my paper, I don't know what I was thinking. In any case, the name is stuck. So let me tell you why this is true. So let's consider, I draw it diagrammatically. So here are two orthogonal states. Orthogonal pure states. These are two orthogonal pure states. And now what I want to do is actually consider a whole, I want to rotate this round through lots of discrete angles. So let's consider another pair of orthogonal states. I'll label these ones with zero, because the angle is zero. And so on. All the way down to one over here. So I'm going to go through lots of equal angles. One up here. There should be one. So the general state.
Excuse me. So the vertical line is P1.
Is P1 zero. Uh-huh. Sorry, that's really small, isn't it? Uh-huh. So the general thing I have is that. And these states are orthogonal for the same L. If you look at one and two, are orthogonal. So they have yeah, so these could be a whole bunch of states in the Bloch sphere rotating through the Z X plane. Yeah. So think of this as the Z X plane. So this is the Z axis and this is the X axis. So I'm just generating L pairs of states in the Z X plane. Is that clear?
Yeah.
I think it's straightforward. Good. So let this be the set of ontic states. Oh, sorry, forgot to introduce what is the thing. So we're going to perform a measurement. So we prepare a state, and then we send it onto a measurement apparatus. And it's going to be a measurement apparatus that is rotated to measure some particular pair of these orthogonal states. So you can rotate L prime in general. And it's going to have two outcomes, O1. So if L prime is equal to L, then you just get the outcome over here corresponding to N. Okay. It's just standard quantum theory. On the other hand, if the L's are not equal, then you get some non-zero probability. That has to be the case. So what we're going to do is we're going to try and model this as an ontological model. So we have some space of ontic states. And so we make these definitions. We say, this is the set of ontic states which can give rise to outcome N when we perform measurement L. And this is the set of ontic states that are in the support of this state. So there's one thing we can say immediately. That this set must be a subset of that set. Is that clear why? imagine this is our state. Now we perform a measurement which projects onto, this is a pure state, we perform a measurement that projects onto this pure state and the one that's orthogonal to it. Well, if we get the outcome corresponding to this pure state, then the on, we know that we have zero probability for getting any other outcome. So all the outcomes have to give rise, all the ontic states in here have to give rise to outcomes in the associated outcome set. Oh, it could be equal. There's this line here. Sorry, there's a chalk mark here. Let me talk.
Doesn't the greater than zero allow for it not to be equal?
That's when L and L prime are different. This is the case where L and L prime are equal.
So if, I mean, when they're equal, don't the ontic states need to be equal?
No, it's possible that this is a bit bigger.
It has to be very nearly equal.
Sorry? In fact, in an ontological model, it would be much bigger. Because an ontological model would just have, a psiontic model. In a psiontic model, you'd have a delta function associated with this pure state.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. So that it can be bigger. Okay.
What was the box you drew again?
Sorry?
What's the box?
So the box was meant to represent all the things in this, all the ontic states in this set, so associated with O, and then the little curve was the distribution for this. So all the things in the support of this belong to this set.
So the row corresponds to the preparation, right?
That's right. Yeah.
So if this in fact is a proper subset.
Yeah.
The things that are not in lambda of rho don't correspond to any preparation.
Say that again. If the thing.
Okay. So the boxes can overlap, just not the.
Yeah, these can overlap. Yeah. So the other outcome would be over here. So let's say this is one. This is two. So these boxes can overlap, but this mustn't go into here. Okay. And we can also say, so it follows from this also that these sets have to be disjoint. Is that clear? So the distribution associated with row 2 of L has to be disjoint. Otherwise, there'd be ontic states in the overlap, which could give rise to either of these two outcomes. Is that clear?
Well, actually, no. Now I have the same question, which is that. So we're saying that these.
Let me bring this box, this diagram down again.
These curves that we've drawn, if we draw another one for another preparation, it can't overlap. Okay.
Yes.
Only your photons can overlap. If they're not all photons, then they can overlap.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this one, I'd better not go into this box. Because if it did, then it could give rise to the wrong outcome.
So
these two have to be, and this one has to be contained inside this box.
So those lambdas we've left out between the two could fall into other.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they could be something else, yeah. But we know for sure that those ones have to be. Okay. Good. So we know that this has to be zero. This has to be the null set. But we also know that this is true. That if you take, if you have this state, so where L prime is not equal to L, then we know that it has some probability of giving rise to either of the outcome sets for the L measurement. Okay, that's the second statement up there. So that implies this result. There have to be ontic states in the support of rho n L prime that overlap with the O n outcome sets of both of them. Okay. And this implies that we have L distinct pairs . So consider the sets of ontic states associated with a particular orthogonal pair of states. So consider that pair. Then every such pair, as you vary L, has to be distinct from every other such pair. And that follows from this property. Not sure how to say that in words. Is it clear why that must be the case? Maybe I use the diagram again. Let's go down. I must have pressed something odd then.
No, I think that you should switch to manual and drag it down.
Well, let me, because I wanted that particular equation. Nope. Okay. I'll try one more time. Nope, it's broken. It's the front one I want to bring down, isn't it? So if you look at this diagram, we know that if we have rho one or two for some other L, so L prime, then it's got to overlap in both boxes. So it can't be the same as this or this. So every pair up there has to be distinct. Okay. And the only way this is possible is if the cardinality of your entire space is greater than or equal to L. That's the only way it's possible to have that number of distinct pairs. And we can have L tend to infinity just by choosing more and more of these, just by choosing smaller and smaller angles up there. So that implies that we need an infinite number of ontic states. So there's stronger results out there in the literature. So Alberto Montina has shown that if you make some assumptions, that the number, then not only do you need an infinite number of ontic states, but actually you need to have two n minus two real parameters to describe your ontic state space. And two n minus two is equal to the number of parameters and the number of real parameters you have in a wave function. So you can write a general wave function like this. So you have two n complex numbers. But then you have to subtract one because you have the overall phase is arbitrary. And then you subtract one more because of normalization, if you choose to normalize. So so you need two n minus two real parameters to describe this ontic state space, according to this is Montina's. Theorem. So these things are kind of a precursor to the result of PBR. The fact that you need two n minus two real parameters already suggests strongly that the thing you want is the wave function. But it doesn't quite prove it. It's just telling you about the size of the state space. So what I'll do, I'll stop in a moment. But what I'll do next time is I'll talk about the toy model of Rob Speckens. So we know that we can't actually build an ontological model which has a finite number of ontic states. So in particular, we can't treat the qubit, for example, with four ontic states because of this theorem. And this is a stronger result. But what we can do is we can build a toy model which has a lot of the same qualitative features as quantum theory. And it's interesting to look at that. It seems to provide some insight into how one might go about building an actual full psi epistemic model that was interesting. So I'll do that next time.